I want to. I know we could probably talk about him for quite some time, but I know we have, as part of our architectural series, we're going to talk about the process of either going through from an architect standpoint, about the process of either renovating a golf course or new construction of a golf course, as part of part of our architectural series. So, I'm just kind of curious. I guess it all starts with. And as a sort of a nice from our part one series of the series where we talked about the client, it sort of segues into the whole idea of the process. And I guess the whole process starts with the client. I mean, I would assume that meeting the client and getting their goals is probably step one of this whole process.
Yeah, if we're talking about an older established course, which is, you know, the vast majority of our work has been on those sort of projects, mm-hmm. then yeah, the club is, I mean, I think there seems to be the way it's worked is they're as interested in what we think about the course as what their goals are. I mean, their simple goal is to, how do we make the golf course better?
Right.
You know, I mean, the times there, they can be obsessed with the course rankings and they worry about those, but you know, they're interested in what we have to say and you often talk to them about it, but more often, well, part of the process is certainly to articulate your vision in some sort of master plan, which is where you see taking the golf course, where its strengths and weaknesses are and how you think you might make it better.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, there's been a lot of rebuilding of Australian golf courses in the last 25 years, really. There's been an awful lot of big, some restoration. In fact, Peter's home course in Victoria, we've done a pretty big restoration project.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of it's been... I want to say redesign. Not massive redesign, but certainly, you know, quite significant changes to golf courses. Mostly keeping the same routing, sometimes mm-hmm. not, but you know, it's mostly keeping the same routing and working with the 18 holes there are and how to make them better. And of course, I'm not sure how much of this happened in America, but Australia. Australian golf and Australian clubs did a pretty bad job of planting golf courses in the 50s and 60s. It was an obsession with planting trees.
Mm-hmm.
And inevitably, 50, 60 years later, those trees have grown up and out and influenced the golf more than I think the original designers ever intended them to be. And they've done, you know, they've had their way with the turf in terms of affecting the quality of the turf, and they've imposed themselves too much on the lines of play. And plus, they often chose, you know, there was no theme to what they were doing with the plantings. There was certainly no reverence for planting indigenous trees in Australia. It was all about, you know, let's plant European trees and Australian native trees. Australia's a big place, and you start planting, trees that are native from northern New South Wales or Western Australia in Melbourne, that they're as out of place as a Russian trees in London. You know, but because it's one country, people thought it was okay to plant native trees from anywhere in the country, and that's been a disaster. So much of the work is about rationalizing and bad tree planting programs. So that's all, often the first step is to let's get the trees organized.
Right. Well, but in new construction, though, you still have to have a definition of an objective from the client. I mean, so obviously we lived through the sort of I like to call the real estateification of golf, right, where everything was golf course and housing. I imagine, though, you still need to get that goal get a definitive goal from a owner, if you will, on what they want. If they choose to use OCCM, you guys have to have some sort of understanding of what the overall goal and plan is for the land.
Absolutely. So, you know, if you're Mike Kaiser, you're the only thing you care about is building the top 100 course in the world. So you go and find great land and you hire an architect and give him a brief to build a great golf course. But if you're a real estate developer who's only interested in selling houses, then you're squeezing the golf in around the houses. And we've never been a part of that market for whatever reason in Australia. That was a market that was largely taken over by Greg Norman, really, in Australia. I mean, Peter Thompson did a few in Melbourne, but Greg was the guy who was charged to sell houses for developers who were building golf around houses. So, you know, it's an interesting form of real estate golf development. But I don't know how that's still working in America. Is that still sort of a big part of the business in America? Certainly in Australia, those projects have, well, there was a flood of them in the 90s and early 2000s, but once the houses are sold, the golf inevitably struggles because most people who buy houses don't play golf.
Right. Yeah, it's sort of slowed. You know, when the real estate market dropped, when that bubble burst, it certainly, you don't see many of those types of developments as a it really depends on the area. If it's a retirement area of some sort, but it's not a lot of you don't see it as much. Certainly, it wasn't able to keep the pace for sure. It wouldn't have been able to sustain itself in general without the bubble bursting. But it doesn't drive it anymore, I don't think.
Yeah. A bigger part of the business here recently, and it's going to be an ongoing big part of the business, is clubs that are no longer viable. I mean, not so many people are joining clubs.
Right.
So we're going to see clubs that are sitting on a lot of money.
Yeah.
In terms of real estate value, there have been a couple of courses recently. In fact, the first course I played as a member was sold for $100 million. Greg Norman built them a new golf course 20 miles further out. We've just finished up rebuilding Peninsula Kingswood, which was the Peninsula site was a 36-hole course. Kingswood was an 18-hole course, which was sold for the same amount, $100 million pretty much. And they relocated their membership to Peninsula, and we've rebuilt that site. So, and of course, Aaron Badley grew up playing. Croydon Golf Club did the same thing. And of course, they went broke within 15 years. They were broke because they, you know, again, what we're talking about, the brief was completely wrong. They had $40 million, I think they got for their land in the late 90s, which sounded like a lot of money, and it kind of was at the time. But they built a bad course, too difficult. They built 27 holes instead of 18. Spent too much money on the clubhouse, and 15 years later, because the course was further out, it never became a popular golf course. It didn't attract new members. They lasted 15 years before someone bought them out, and they now lease the course from the new owner. And then the course I grew up playing, Easton, did pretty much the same thing. You know, they got Greg Norman to build a big, difficult Greg Norman golf course. They built 27 holes in a par 3 course, when they, in truth, only needed 18 holes. And it wasn't a great piece of land, and they spent a lot of money on the clubhouse. And, I mean, hopefully it works. But it'll be interesting to see how it goes.
Yeah, we...
You kind of wonder what the brief was. I mean, from when I wasn't involved, so I don't... clearly the brief was we want more than 18 holes.
Mm-hmm.
And they had $100 million, which is a lot more money to spend, but apparently they spent a lot of it, which is, I think if you're going to make such an important move, then you would want to have at least 50 of it left over, which is what Peninsula have done. I mean, you know, they've put, I think, certainly half of the $100 million away, and they can't ever touch that. They can spend the income they make from the 50, but you know, I think the plan is to always have that as a backup. So that's going to be a big part of golf in Australia in the future, is how unviable clubs, how they manage themselves. Because what the other part of the fight is going to be that local government are going to start resisting clubs that are cashing in because they see the importance of open space and that they don't necessarily want developers coming in and taking over golf clubs and covering 150 acres of open woodland in houses.
Yeah.
So at some point that'll fish up in a court because the clubs will argue that we're the only business in the country that when we go bankrupt, we can't realize the value of our asset.
Right.
And that'll be an interesting fight amongst the lawyers when it comes to that. Because the alternative is to put a fence around it and walk away and just let the grass grow. And that's not viable in the long term because, you know, that becomes a haven for people to dump cars and light fires. And
sure.
You know, you can't be having that in the middle of suburbia, just an unkempt for woodland that no one cares about. So at some point the lawyers will be arguing about the legality of clubs being able to realize the value of their asset.
We just had not very long ago, an A.W. Tillinghast course, not 15 minutes from my house, that had been on the brink for a long time and finally lost its battle to survive. And will be now, subsequently, will be a development. Case in point, really.
So it was a private club?
Yeah, it was a private club, and it tried to hang on for as long as it could. Okay. And so, go ahead.
So what do the members do? Do they cash in and go and join with another club, or do they go and build a new course, or do they?
No, it was sold to a developer. That's it. The club.
So who owned the club? Did the members own the club?
The members owned the club, and that was it.
So where does the money go?
I don't know all the details of it, to be fair. I just know that now they're fighting over the development. So that's where they're at with it.
Because the law in Australia is you can't, which I think is different from Canada. I heard that happened in Canada where they sold a club and the members just put the money up amongst themselves. You can't do that here.
Okay.
So if you sell a golf course, the money goes to the government.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, this
can't, you know, the members can't vote to sell a golf club and then pocket the profits amongst themselves.
Right.
But they can sell it and reinvest it in golf somewhere else.
Okay.
Which certainly stops members just cashing in and taking their $400,000 each or whatever it is and clearing off. They can't do that here. But
yeah, and, you know, and it wasn't a I don't know the answer to that question, to be honest, and I would assume that it depended on how much money you made would be depend on how long you were a member, how much equity you had in the club or whatever. I don't know exactly how it all worked out. I'll find out, actually, and now I'm interested in finding out what the law is. But anyway, nonetheless, your case in point, it will now be housing, and now they're fighting over the traffic patterns and all that stuff.
Yeah. So the members go and join another club, presumably, or not.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, you know, Long Island's pretty compressed, and it's obviously, as you well know, not very cheap.
No, it's expensive.
And so it's not like you're just going to go and join Friar's Head, you know? I mean, So, and it's the South Shore doesn't have where I live. I live basically, if you imagine, the center of Long Island. I mean, I'm on the South Shore of Long Island. So there's not in that center area. There's really only on the South Shore. There's only really two courses, and it's not. And there's only one really where I am, and that's Southwood Ho, and that's another Tillinghast course, which will always be around. That's going to survive for forever. That's very much very healthy. But then there's Colonial Springs, which is, if you want to call it, I wouldn't call it the South Shore. It's more a little east of me, a little west of me, and more center of the island. And then that's it. And that's a Fazio course that's 27 holes. And that seems to be doing okay. You know, there's never been any rumblings or anything like that. So you have those two courses, and then in terms of private golf, now you know you have to either have to go all the way west, where you're talking about your, you know, your garden cities on the South Shore and all that stuff.
Okay.
And then, or you go all the way east, where you got your, where your South, you know, your Southamptons and your, you know, Nationals and Shinnecocks and all that stuff. So in the middle on the South Shore, you're very, is very low, very few options for those people to have the convenience if you can't afford to, let's say, or if you can even get in at Southwood Ho, let's say, so to speak. So it's either really your only two options if you wanted to be close to home and not drive 25 minutes to play, where you might have been driving 5 minutes to play. You only have two choices. So, you know, I don't know what they're doing.
So we're rebuilding a course we just started last week. It's a beachside course about 2 hours out of Melbourne. They sold, you know, an old club, old members, no money. I mean, and they've been broke for 15 years, basically. I mean, they've just struggled along on the smell of an oily rag. But they realized eventually the value of their first four holes, which was about, I think, $40 million probably.
Mm-hmm.
So they bought some adjacent farmland to build the four new holes, and they're rebuilding the other 14. And, you know, the brief, their brief, it's a holiday course, is, you know, it's a 5,000, I'm talking meters now, although I'm a yards guy. So I need to convert, 5,800 meters. So it's about 6,200 yards,
mm-hmm.
par 70, and, I mean, absolutely no desire to make a championship course or just make a good, fun little golf course for people to go and play on holidays, and which is really it's the perfect length golf course for people who, for 90% of people who play golf, it's a perfect length course. I mean, I'm a member at Metropolitan where they're playing the World Cup this year. It's probably the longest, sort of, certainly one of the longest two or three courses in Australia. 7,400 yards, probably 300 or 400 yards. But all the members I play with, they'd be much better off playing 6,200 yards.
Sure.
They would, you know, they would hit some greens. They would have, you know, it's a great course to play. It's a tremendous golf course. But yeah, a 6,200 or 300 yard course is much more relevant to the golf they play than 7,300 yards.
Oh, without question.
So it's hard to convince. Well, Lonsdale is not a, you know, it wasn't a hard place to convince. Well, They didn't have the space to put anything bigger, in fairness. But even if they had, I think, you know, their brief would have been, we just want a fun little seaside golf course. It's windy. It's makes some great, fun golf holes. And, of course, the irony, I'm actually writing an article for the Australian Golf Architects Society magazine, which comes out annually, about the good things that have happened as a result of the ball going so much further.
Right.
I'm a hater of, I mean, I detest what the ball's done, and it's time they pulled it back 30, you know, 10%. But the holes that have benefited the most from the ball going so much further are the short holes. The irony is that the great little tricky 120 and 30 yard par threes in America, the most famous, probably the 7th at Pebble Beach or the 10th at Pine Valley or the 13th at Marion, but there are a bunch of them in Australia.
The 10th in Shinnecock?
The 11th at Shinnecock.
11th at Shinnecock, excuse me.
Yeah, you know, those holes are no easier with the new ball because you've gone from hitting a, you know, a 7 or 8 iron to a 9 iron or a wedge, and you know, they're difficult because, you know, they're surrounded by difficult hazards that you don't save a par if you miss the green.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're difficult because of the wind. They're difficult because the targets are small. So those holes haven't been affected by the ball, you know, the modern ball. The great, you know, sub 300 yard holes that are now more dangerous because they're reachable. Holes that players would just play safely off the tee with the 10th at Riviera, where you would bump a 4 iron down the left and pitch it onto the green. Now it's a much more dangerous hole because you can drive it. So whilst more guys are liable to make three, they're also five is much more likely too, because there's so much more trouble to get into if you drive at it.
Right.
And then the long three shot par five is arguably the most difficult hole to make interesting if you're a designer. You know, now those holes are within reach of, you know, 580 yards is easy within reach now for the longest hitters. So you would argue those holes are more interesting. So the very longest holes have become more interesting because they play shorter. The tiny par threes are just as dangerous, and the great short par fours are more dangerous.
Right.
So the holes that have been decimated, the 200-yard par threes have turned into six irons, and the 450-yard par fours that used to be drives and five irons are now drives and wedges. And the great sort of, you know, 520-yard par fives that were risk and reward and multiple shades of grey par fives that do I go or do I not go, they've just turned into drives and six irons.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's a lot to be said for building a 5,800-metre course. You can build some great little short fours and cool little par threes and, you know, make the game really interesting for... I mean, our goal is often... We say to a client that, you know, our goal is to build a course that's interesting for Jeff Ogilvie, but also interesting for his dad and also interesting for his mum. And, you know, if you achieve those three goals, then you build a pretty good golf course, I think.
Sure.
So it's a often used, you know, we've said that thing more than once to committees that, you know, we're trying to build a course that's good for Jeff and good for his dad and good for his mum.
So, yeah.
You know, that's not a bad way to look at golf, really. And, of course, that's why his favourite course in the world is Swinley Forest, which is a...
Right.
You know, it's a 6,000... One or 200 yard past 68. He said, but I can go there and play with my dad and we can both have a great day because the hard holes are hard.
Right.
And there was I think six par threes there. I mean, great par threes. And for a player as good as him, they're still, you've got to hit great shots. And the long par fours are long and the short par fours are great fun. And it's a day packed full of great golf.
Yeah.
But he can play with his dad, and his dad's not beating his brains out on a 7,000-yard golf course.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you can match those two things together, then, you know, you've got yourself a pretty good golf course. And, of course, you won't find too many clients who are saying, build me a 6,200-yard golf course. But, of course, that, despite what I said about the argument about, you know, the ball going, you know, the short holes being... more interesting with the shorter ball, you know, if you could drag the ball back a decent amount, then for a guy like, you know, a tour player, you can make 6,800 yards a really good, interesting, relevant test again.
Sure.
Which is the sort of length that, you know, the average golfer should be playing all the time. But, you know, the game is so far apart now that, going back to the original question, if you're building for, and we do it here often because most of the old golf courses we work at, like Karen up in Perth, which holds the Perth International, which is a European Tour event, Royal Queensland, which has got a chance to hold a big tournament in the next few years, the Lakes, which has the Australian Open this year, and Kingston Heath in Victoria, which two clients who had just been announced last week, they're going to hold the 2020 and 2022 Australian Opens. So many of the courses we work at hold the biggest tournaments in Australia. So always a part of that, you know, a constant part of working at clubs like that is how do we stay relevant for top-class play? So it's always a question for those clubs is what do we do? And, of course, yeah. You know, they're all running out of room. You know, Victoria and, I mean, Kingston Heath, you know, the first tee's literally on the very edge of the clubhouse. You take one step off the back of the first tee and you're on the porch of the clubhouse.
Right, right.
So, they're stretched within an inch of their lives, those places, but they're always trying to find more. They played the World Cup at Kingston Heath in 2016 and, you know, it was amazing how far. It never ceases to amaze me how far those guys drive it. I mean...
Oh, it's crazy.
You know, for anyone who's played Kingston Heath, the 17th hole was a par five, and Mackenzie and Dan Souter. Well, Dan Suter routed the golf course, and McKenzie came and bunkered it a few years later. It was a blind par five second shot, which became a par four in the very late 60s. It became a par four. But John Rahm drove it on top of the hill. I mean, he could see the green at the World Cup, which was, I mean, no one ever believed that was possible.
The
tee's hard up against the road. You can't move the tee back an inch. So it's
sure.
You know how you defend those courses, because that whole list of courses, you know, they were built as our championship courses. They were our equivalent of Shinnecock and Augusta and Oakmont and Riviera and LA Country Club and Muirfield and Troon and St Andrews, and they were our equivalent golf courses. So, you know, whenever you're talking to the committees, inevitably the question is how do we stay relevant and how do we maintain our relevance as championship golf courses? And of course, it's not only professional play, but you know, they all hold Australian amateurs and state amateurs and state opens and, you know, first class amateur play. And every amateur who's worth his salt in Australia hits a ball as far as all the good pros now. Mm-hmm. You know, they all drive at 300 yards.
Sure.
So how do we make how do we keep these courses relevant for the best players?
You mentioned on one of the projects you bought some farmland for another four holes,
yeah.
And it just made me think of let's use a new construction as an example. How important is the field study and understanding the land? How critical is it in the process? Obviously, I know it's very critical, but I mean, there's a lot of parts to this process of. But I'm just wondering, in your mind, where that kind of fits in everything in terms of its importance to understanding exactly what you're dealing with when it comes to the land.
Well, every site's different, but clearly the land is critical to the routing of the golf course. I mean how do you route it? So how do you find the best holes, and how do you make it the easiest walk, and does the client want a returning nine-hole golf course, or can you go out? I mean, you wonder how many golf courses were compromised because the ninth hole had to come back to the clubhouse.
Right.
You know, was that the best way to route the golf course, or did that yield the best golf course, or was the fact that the client wanted the ninth hole or the tenth tee by the clubhouse to how much does that compromise the golf course, if at all? And for some places, you could argue that it hugely compromised it. Others, you could argue that it didn't compromise it at all. But, you know, a place like Sandhills in Nebraska, you know, ninth hole comes back to the first tee, basically. But,
mm-hmm.
you know, that was a course that could have gone in any one of 100 directions, really.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the questions is, you know, if the ninth hole didn't come back to the first tee, then how much different would the golf course have been? And so, of course, understanding the site and walking over it, and, you know, of course, I guess a good site is the one that's almost the hardest to route because there are so many options. It's that famous Perry Maxwell quote about Prairie Dunes: "Is there are 118 great holes here? I've just got to get rid of 100 of them."
Right.
Which, when you go to Sandhills, you can see how Bill and Ben went out there, and it's like, how the hell do you figure out, how do you even know if you've got the best golf course here? Because there are so many alternatives to what you're going to do here. Yeah, I mean, one of the few new courses we did here, a place called Ranfurly, just out of Melbourne, it was a small site, it was not a great piece of land, but it was decent. But there were only one or two ways to route that golf course. You could go clockwise or anti-clockwise, but because it was such a small site, there were very few options with what you could do. But we've got a piece of land in Hobart that we're hopeful that they'll build a golf course on in the next few years. And it's a pine forest in sand dunes on the water. It's arguably you know, the best site anyone's ever had to build a golf course on. It's incredible because it's enough for three golf courses, but it's one part Pine Valley on the ocean, one part the Heathlands Sunnydale type course on the ocean. On a bay on the other side of it.
Right.
You know, it's a spit of land that goes out into the water.
Wow.
So, you know, we've walked that land for, you know, days and days and days. And, you know, we'll never know if we've ever come up with the best routing because, you know, it's impossible to know because there are so many options. And no matter which way you, where you put the clubhouse or where you start, in any direction, there's a great hole. And you walk that hole and you look in any direction and there's another great hole and then you get to that green and you look in one of two or three directions and there's another great hole and then you hit the water and you turn around. It's just a staggeringly great piece of land. For someone to say, yep, let's go and do it. It's always a risk to build a golf course. But
yeah.
Of all the great stuff Mike Kaiser's done, it's all in Rome, Wisconsin, and Bandon, Oregon, and you know, Nova Scotia, and you know, Dornoch, in way up there in the top of Scotland, and
right.
Bumboogle Dunes, which is in the top of Tasmania. This place is 10 minutes from Hobart Airport and 20 minutes in the middle, you know, from the middle of the city. But in terms of the quality of that land, I don't think anyone will ever know whether we've come up with the best routing because there are literally hundreds of possible routings for it. So at some point you've got to say, okay, this is what we're going to do.
Right.
And then no matter what you pick, you've got to go and build great holes.
Well, and
of course you've...
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, I'm done.
I was just going to say, you know, and one of the things that I think that people forget about, you know, there are lots of people out there, talking about golf course architecture and existing architecture and making holes better and doing this and doing that. And I think people forget, you know, I think nobody ever talks about the fact that there's a budget involved. And when you talk about picking, you know, doing a field study and understanding the land, and yes, you have to figure out the routing, but the soil is going to affect how you're going to irrigate it, how you're going to drain it. Is it going to be difficult to move earth? Is it going to be difficult to, do we need a state-of-the-art drainage system here? That's going to affect the cost. And so now you can have drainage can affect, you know, ultimately how many bunkers you have on a hole or how many features you have on a hole or whatever. You know, it's not an unlimited, I think people forget about how interconnected the process is. And it's not a it's not just a blank slate all the time. And there are a lot of things to consider in this whole process. You could have a wonderful site, but if you have a very unbelievably tight budget, I mean, you know, there's only so much you can do. But yet we have all these people talking about all these things about how they would do this or do that or whatever. But of course, maybe they wanted to do this and they wanted to do that. But there are lots of things to consider here, you know?
No doubt. And of course, the irony of the great courses that have been built in the last 20 years is most of them have been the cheapest ones to build.
Right.
You go to Sandhills in Nebraska and the land costs nothing and the construction barely costs anything.
Right.
And of course, it works the other way, is that some of the most ridiculous golf courses have cost the most to build.
Right.
But, yeah, you're right. You know, you would like to think that one of the most important jobs of the architect is to minimize the cost of the project for the owner, because it's done no one any good having golf courses go broke because they cost too much to build.
Right.
You know, the worst thing the game can do is build these unsustainable golf courses that cost fortunes to build, because it just gives the game such a bad name.
Well, not just cost to build, but cost to maintain too.
Cost to maintain, yeah, exactly. It's crazy how much this stuff costs. I mean, you know, again, Easton, the course I grew up at. I mean, you know, if the number I heard was right, then it was just staggering how much they spent on something that should have cost, you know, they could have done it for $30 million probably,
right?
Which sounds like an awful lot, but it was more than that. I mean, we built Rand Furley for, you know, admittedly it was 20 years ago, but the land was $2 million. The construction was about 3.5. The clubhouse was 4 or 5.
Right.
Yes. You know, so for less than $10 million, the golf club got a brand new golf course, and they eventually sold their other course for, I think they got $30 or $40 million for it. So whilst they were, you know, a sort of typically struggling out of suburban golf course, financially they're in a great position now because they didn't spend much doing what they were doing because they didn't waste their money. And they chose a good site that wasn't going to cost a lot to build on. You know, but the average, you know, again, to use other examples in Melbourne, a committee chooses a site when they've got no idea what they're looking at.
Right.
And they get talked into something by an architect who tells them it's great, or a developer who convinces them that, yeah, we'll find you a site, because all the developer really cares about is
housing.
Getting his hands on the other side to build houses on it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's a good course in Melbourne that hasn't relocated yet, and hopefully they don't, because they've actually got a pretty good golf course. But they've been conned into moving to a terrible site by someone who's convinced them that they can build Royal Melbourne out of a bit of flat junk clay. And you kind of can if you spend, you know, unlimited budget, but you know, there isn't an unlimited budget to spend. It's just what I mean, the way forward for that club is to merge with another club,
right?
Of which there are a few struggling ones in the area. You know, merge with another club. There are two terrible courses within 15 minutes of each other. Sell one of those, put houses on it, realize the 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90, or $100 million, reinvest in this club,
right,
and make it really good.
Yeah.
There's no reason why you couldn't make it a fantastic golf course. But, you know, that's part of the rationalization of golf. And my view is that to make golf better, certainly in Melbourne, where it's certainly the most competitive city for golf in Australia,
mm-hmm.
The best way to advance the game is to rationalize it and to get rid of the poor courses, realize the value of them.
Right.
And then go one step up to the struggling courses that are still pretty good and make them better. And that's what Kingswood did when they sold up and they went to Peninsula. And, you know, the new courses at Peninsula, I think, are going to be both in the top 10 in the country probably, which now is a pretty high bar in Australia. When I started playing golf in 1970, the 10th best course in Australia, if you look back, was a pretty good golf course, but it was a place like Kingston Heath, which was a long way from where it had been in 1930, because they'd filled in bunkers and planted trees on it. It was in bad shape, and you know, it certainly wasn't the golf course it is now, which is it's a much better golf course than when I first saw it.
Yeah.
So the top 10 bar now in Australia is pretty high. Much sure. Higher than it was 30 years ago.
Well,
so you can argue that a big part of the slowdown in building new courses, and certainly it's happened in America, is that whilst there's been a slowdown in building new courses, where the business is going is restoring, renovating, rejuvenating, redesigning, whatever you want to call it, old courses and making them better. And I think that's arguably just as important as running off and building new courses everywhere, because you know, there are so many not the top echelon of golf courses probably, but that next level down can be so much better. It can certainly be so much better than Australia.
Well, I think it doesn't matter if you're building a house or building a golf course. It always costs more to fix a screw up than it does to make it do it right the first time. And I think we've gone through that. We've gone through that phase, I think, of the bloat of you know, golf course building, and now people are coming to their senses, and And to be fair, it's been nice to have this regeneration of people like yourself and lots of, I'm not even going to name, there's plenty of these sort of, these architects that are trying to bring back, you know, strategy and old golden age architecture, if you will, and all that stuff. But I think people are coming to their senses now that it's they need to think about. They just have to come to their senses, really, and that what they had and what they've done was just a really a caricature of what golf used to be or what it was.
Yeah, there's been a fundamental change in the design business in the last 20 or 30 years where you've got, I mean, it seems like the last year or so there's been this realization amongst the wider world that, you know, the architect superstars are now not famous professional players, but Bill Corr and Gil Hanson, Doak and guys like that who are, you know, doing such good work. But there are so many good young architects around, Carl France and guys like that. There was a young kid, Josh McFadden, who works for Gil Hanson. He's up building a project for Gil in Bangkok now. It's a rainy season, so he's he came down to Melbourne for 3 weeks and we played pretty much every day in the Sandbelt. And first time he'd been there, and he was a 28-year-old kid who knows as much about design as I do. He was tremendous handle on building and thinking about the game and how it should work. And, you know, there are so many great, smart young kids who are going to take the game to some, you know, the next 50 years. I think the game's in tremendous shape with the really talented young 30 to 40 year olds who are really good at what they're doing. And, you know, they're jumping on machines and learning how to, you know, they're working for Gil and Tom and Bill and Ben, and, you know, they're learning the business from the ground up and driving machines and thinking about it and going down to Melbourne for 3 weeks and going to Royal Melbourne and Kingston Heath and Metropolitan and Woodlands and Spring Valley and seeing all the best courses and thinking about them and taking photos and going away. And, you know, he's gone back to Canada, and he gave me a great insight of, you know, to golf in Canada in terms of how he thought it could be better. He was amazed at the quality of golf in Melbourne and how much better it was than it is in Canada, and how he thought they needed to, you know, move things forward to make for better golf there. But, you know, it's such a different game there because they only play for, you know, it's a concept completely unknown and foreign to us that golf is not a 12-month-a-year game, where, of course, we're in the middle of winter now and it's still beautiful conditions for golf. It's cold and windy, but,
right,
you know, he was kind of laughing at, you know, our cold weather last week. He said, this is great weather for us. He said, this is Canada in the fall. Is, you know, this is our golf season. This is what it's like.
Right.
You know, so we complain about our winters, but, you know, we're incredibly lucky to play golf as a year-round sport, barely without putting an umbrella up or putting on a waterproof jacket or.
Right.
You know, Australia's a great place to play golf year-round.
Well, I just want to go on record that I've told you about my my plan to win Mega Millions for you and the boys to restore my little favorite par 3 course. That the, you know, you could have whatever, you'll have carte blanche, but the only caveat is that it's the maintenance budget that's the real thing. That's a real, you know, when I thought about it and thinking about the process and our conversations, I mean, this is not even a town run course. It's an incorporated village run course. So you can imagine what the, you know, their budget is to maintain it. Not that it's in bad shape or anything like that, but that would have to be the, you know, one of the ultimate considerations, to be honest with you, in the renovation and the whole property, because, you know, so it's got to last after you leave, right? You know?
Yeah. I think certainly a big part of the last couple of decades has been the importance architects have put on bunkers and how they look.
Right.
You know, we've all seen the frilly edge bunkers and going back to that stuff, but, you know, people are starting to question about, you know, have we built too many bunkers? Have we overused them as hazards? And Mackenzie had, 34 bunkers at Augusta when he first did it? And,
yeah.
You know, a big part of golf design. Well, not, you know, I wonder whether one of the next trends is for architects to figure out how to make the game interesting without over-bunkering or, using bunkers much more sparingly than we have. Because one of the most interesting courses in London is, or just out of London, is Royal Ashdown Forest, which was built on Crown land, I think, or there was certainly something. It's an old golf course, but
right.
part of the permit was that they couldn't build bunkers on it.
Is building bunkers, would you say that is the putting too many bunkers is maybe one of the first rookie mistakes an architect can make?
Probably, yeah, because now, we've gotten so much into how building great looking bunkers.
Right.
So it's always tempting if you can to build a great looking bunker, but
right.
The question always is it really superfluous to a golf? Does it make the golf better?
Right.
Or does it just look good? So how can we make the game interesting and fun whilst building fewer and fewer bunkers? And I play with Sue O, who's a LPGA player who's back in Melbourne now for 3 weeks before she goes to the Scottish Open. We play with her sister, who's just started playing golf. She's been playing for 6 months. And we joke that she thinks the idea of the game is to see how many bunkers you can go into. Because she just loves hitting the ball into bunkers.
Right.
But Metropolitan, the Sandbelt Golf Course, which is the bunkers are the primary hazards on what is a championship golf course. But for a beginner, she gets overwhelmed by the bunkers because there are so many of them, and she's always in the bunkers. And
right.
Of course, one thing I suppose it's good, she's learning how to play bunker shots, because, which in terms means she's learning the grip, because you can't play a bunker shot with a bad grip. So she's learning how to grip the club properly, and she's getting to be, for a beginner, she's pretty competent. But, you realize how bunkers beat beginners up if there are too many of them.
Oh,
and whilst you could argue, because Sue and I are good players, we don't think there are too many bunkers.
Right.
But when you see a sister play, you go, there are too many bunkers.
Right.
We could do with filling in half of these things.
Right.
So when Alistair McKenzie went to Royal Sydney in 1926, they had 365 bunkers, which is obviously an easy number to remember. But he filled in, I don't know how many he filled in, but it was probably in three figures. Yes, it's crazy. Just get rid of this stuff.
Right.
But going back to Royal Ashdown Forest, when you play the golf course, if you send someone there, and at the end of the day, you ask them, you didn't tell them there weren't any bunkers. If you ask them what was one of the most notable features about the golf course, many of them would not say there aren't any bunkers there. Because right. There's so much interest around the greens that you don't notice there aren't any bunkers. In fact, there's another course in New Zealand, a place called Arrowtown, which is the irony of Arrowtown is it's over the road from a place called The Hills, which is where they play the New Zealand Open. The Hills is $1,000 green fee, and Arrowtown's $45.
Jesus.
And Arrowtown's a great golf course. Tom Doak discovered it and raves about it. It's a brilliant golf course. It has no bunkers. There's not one bunker. Well, there is a bunker on the golf course. There's a bunker on the practice chipping green, which is, you kind of got to wonder why there's a bunker on the practice chipping green when there are no bunkers on the golf.
That's course. Pretty funny.
It's a tremendous golf course.
It sounds like something Doak would do, right?
Doak didn't build it. The golf. It's an old golf course. The members have no idea how good this place is. It's kind of built through rocks and boulders.
Oh,
and
okay.
It's quirky and it's fun and it's just. And I'm sure the members don't think it's any good because no one rates. There are three big new resorts in Queenstown, which is a beautiful kind of Queenstown. It's an amazingly beautiful place. And Millbrook, Jack's Point, and the Hills are three high green fee, very famous tourist courses in Queenstown. And Arrowtown's the old fashioned golf course that's $45 a round and probably. Certainly less than $1,000 a year to be a member. And the members didn't realize how good it was until a few of us went down there and started saying, this place is fantastic. But it has no bunkers. But if you played there, like Royal Ashdown Forest, if you didn't point it out, many people who played there wouldn't realize that there weren't any bunkers because there's so much other interest in the golf course that you don't notice that there aren't any bunkers.
Right.
So I think it'll be, I think there's a place for an architect to go out there and build a golf course that doesn't have bunkers, you know, and to see what you can build around the greens that makes the game interesting without having to build them. And there are lots of examples of great holes with the great bunkerless holes. The third of Royal Adelaide's a great bunkerless hole with a really cool ridge down the edge of the green. And, you know, if you drive it left, it's a short par four, you've got to pitch over this gnarly kind of diagonal ridge on the left side of the green. But if you drive it right down the line of the sand dune on the right, you get a clear little pitch into the green. And so, you know, someone will do it. And I think it would be certainly an incredibly popular course amongst beginners who aren't very good at bunkers necessarily. But, I mean, perhaps not no bunkers, but certainly Mackenzie's philosophy of 34 bunkers at Augusta, that's enough. So in terms of going back to the course you're talking about, yeah, I mean, doing it with less is often more.
Yeah.
You get what I mean?
Yeah, no, for sure. I'm going to skip the, I would think the, I know we're talking about the whole process from A to Z, but I think we can just, we all know that we're dealing with a lot of, especially with a new golf course, permits and insurance and bonds and all that stuff. And that's just crazy. It's the world we live in that, and insurance, and I think we can all admit that that's no fun part of the process. But nonetheless is part of the process, and also finding, good people to work in the field. And, you know, I'm sure you have to, at some point, have to subcontract some parts of it out. I know you have your own shapers and whatnot, but there you have to subcontract, I would think, irrigation and drainage and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So there's that part of it. You have to go through that process of vetting those guys and those people. I mean, and I would imagine that you'd have to deal with, and then maybe some, if you're dealing with a renovation, you got committees that you have to sort of walk the site with on an annual, periodically, and you're going to have to go back and forth. I'm curious if you think that, in your experience, how much do committees, which can be either a blessing or a curse, if they bring it to a grinding halt, but how much do you think that they, let me ask it this way. It'd be nice on some hands have me as a client and be like, listen, just come back and tell me when it's done, and just show me what you're doing. But, that's not going to work with a private golf club and a committee, but, how often do you find yourself maybe being pushed by them in a good way, not necessarily in a difficult way, but making you think about what you're planning to do?
That's an interesting question. Let me think about that one.
Yeah.
I think that we've been lucky enough to generally, not always, but generally work with terrific committees who, if you spend a lot of time with them and get to know them well, they get to understand what you're on about, your vision for the golf course. They trust you. In Australia, it's a small place, so they generally talk to each other so that if you go to one club, that have spoken to a previous client that we've worked out who will sort of explain how we work as, so that kind of word of mouth things goes around. But we've been incredibly lucky with committees who've largely given us a free hand in terms of letting us do what we want. We certainly have discussions I'm not going to say arguments because I don't think we've really ever had an argument, but you certainly discuss what you want to do, and mostly I don't want to say win, because if you, as my wife says, stop trying to win arguments, because if you're winning, someone's losing.
Right.
So, and I think that's a good philosophy in terms of arguments, but if you're making a good case for what you want to do and you're working with a good client, they will most often, if you're making good cases, they'll agree with you and go with it. And generally, if you're any good at what you do, you'll pull it off. Not always, but
right.
Yeah. I mean, I'm the first to admit, you know, we've screwed some holes up, but you know, you generally you can pull it off if you're good at what you do, and if you make a good case for why you want to do something, then we've been fortunate enough to work with people who've given us our head, really. But you know, more tricky than the committee are the members, because you don't get to talk to all the members, and you hear conversations about, you know, not members at specific clubs, but just golfers in general.
Right.
Talking about, you know, I heard three of our guys today at another table at the golf club talking about another golf club, and you kind of shake your head and go, you guys got no idea. You
know? Right, right.
You know, just completely clueless.
But, yeah.
You know, some people have some ideas, some have none, some have a lot of it. You know, some are terrific. And often there are members who make interesting suggestions. We redid a par three at the lake in Sydney where the Australian Open is this year. And we, the green used to be flat on the ground, and it had been redone twice since Bruce Devlin and Robert Von Hagge did it in their early 70s. And the green finished up way up in the air, and we got it back on the ground. And we built a bigger green than the original. And there are a few members who were critical of what we'd done because they thought it was too easy to run the ball onto the green. And it was the last hole. So even though it shouldn't be any more important than any other hole, because it was the last hole and has been the last hole at many Australian Opens, it was, you know, it was more important than it might otherwise have been if it had been the 13th hole. And a few members thought there was not enough interest at the front of the green, and we thought about it and thought, you know, they're right. And we went out and went back and carved out a big hollow at the front left of the green and made the hole infinitely better than the original we'd done.
Right.
So it was an interesting case of, you know, a couple of members who were not necessarily, one was a 20 handicapper, who thought the hole would be more interesting for something to, he was a short hitter who thought, well, you know, it's too easy to run the ball into the green, and he was right.
Right.
So, you know, you don't ever want to close your mind off to someone who's got an interesting suggestion. But more often than not, you know, I think it was Tillinghast who spoke about pay no attention to the carping critic, because, you know, for everyone who's going to come up with a worthwhile criticism of some of your work, there will be 20 that will come up with some ridiculous ideas about why such and such a hole's no good, when they're clearly not thinking about the question the hole's asking.
Right. Well, I just find it interesting that in your example there, that it was the 20 handicap that said that it was too easy to run the ball onto the green. I know he was probably right, but you would think in general, as a general understanding of the 20 handicap, that that's what he would want. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, because it's a 180 or 90 yard par three. When Steve Elkington won the Open there, he was hitting, was into the wind, he was hitting a 2-iron.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there have been days when guys have hit 5s and 6 irons, but it was generally a hole where you flew the ball onto the green. You didn't think about running it up so much, but
right.
it was a 20 marker who always ran the ball onto the green.
Right.
And he was making a pretty good point.
Yeah. No, and the 20 handicap should be, I don't want to give away, because I know we're going to do a piece on bunkering, but, you know, well, I'm going to save it, but I'll write it down so I remember. But I would argue that there was a good time where architects in the 80s and 90s stopped challenging the 20 handicaps, and thus they stopped trying to get better. Well, as a result, they didn't get better either, because they were not being challenged. And so now, you know, you get a 20 handicapper thinking about the opening to a green, you know, in a way you're helping them improve their own golf game by making it a little bit challenging without it being, you know, a nightmare.
Yeah, the irony of a 20 marker is that if you put a bunker in that affects them, they will often criticize it. by saying it only affects me. You know, it doesn't affect the good players. It only affects the bad player.
Right.
But my argument is that bunkers are there to make the game interesting. And as long as you don't overuse them, putting a bunker 170 yards off a tee makes the game interesting for someone who flies the ball 175 yards. And if you fill in all those hazards, you're treating those golfers with contempt because you're taking away all the interest.
Sure.
Because you're not building hazards that stimulate them to think about making the same decision that Tiger Woods makes about a bunker that's 290 yards off the tee.
Exactly.
It's the same decision.
Exactly.
You know, for me, the carry might be 250 yards. For Jeff Ogilvie's mum, it might be 130 yards. For Jeff Ogilvie's dad, it might be 190 yards. And for, you know, by just building bunkers that only affect good players. Well, I'm a good player, but you don't want a bunker across from me because there's nothing in play for Jeff Ogilvie.
Right.
And you certainly don't want to build a bunker, a golf course for Jeff Ogilvie because those bunkers are in the road of most players' second shots. Excuse me. And they're only affecting a tour-class player, of which there are, you know, it's not just tour players, but, you know, there are 20 or 30 members of the club who making a 290-yard carry might affect. So randomly placing bunkers all over the golf course so they affect everybody.
Right.
Ought to be the aim. But the problem with that is that the people who criticise that philosophy the most are the front markers who just see, or you know, I'm generalising, but who see bunkers as an aggravation. You know, they're there to make the game, well, they're there to make the game of misery because they only affect me. So what are you building stuff that affects me? I'm a bad enough player as it is. They're not seeing the bunker as something that makes the game interesting. Of course, it's the architect's job to put them somewhere where they do make the game interesting. You don't just randomly chuck a bunker out at 170 yards necessarily, but
right.
You know, put them in, pick the holes, pick the right hole, and put it in a spot where it asks someone who hits the ball 170 yards in the air a really interesting question.
Yeah, definitely.
So dumbing a golf course down and not building hazards that affect 20 markers is the surest way to make the game uninteresting for them. And you know, it was McKenzie who said, no bunker's unfairly placed no matter where it is. You know, it's a player's duty to deal with it, handle it, manage it. But don't just go and bunker golf courses for tour players because that's the surest way to make a golf course that no one's going to want to play.
Yeah. Well, I think that probably would be a good spot because I don't want to give away or bleed into any of the other. But I think we've covered most of the design process. I mean, from A to Z and what you're thinking about it, unless I missed anything, Mike, do you think so?
No, I think we've done long enough. Hopefully there are still people who are hanging on listening to it, but and hopefully it's interesting and they've got a little bit of Peter Thompson, which is always worthwhile because, you know, so.
Yeah. No, I think so. And I think we'll, and then we can, we'll figure out the rest of the sequence. But I want to thank you for your time. And it's always a pleasure to have you on and look forward to our next series.
Thanks, Anthony. I enjoyed it.
All right. Thank you, Mike. And that was Mike Clayton from OCCM Design. Always fun to talk to him. Folks, thanks for tuning in. Hopefully you learned a little something, as I always do. And we'll see you next week. You're talking to On Par with Anthony Scorsese.